been because Katrina the camel was sucking on my hair. Apophis wants us to free his arch-enemy? That makes no sense.
I can't explain it, Bast said, but as I got closer to his cage, I could glean his thoughts. I suppose because we fought so many centuries, we have some sort of connection. At any rate, the equinox begins tomorrow at sunset, as I said. The following dawn, the morning of March 21st, Apophis intends to rise from the Duat. He plans to swallow the sun and destroy the world, and he believes your plan to awaken Ra will help him do that.
Walt frowned. If Apophis wants us to succeed, why is he trying so hard to stop us? Is he? I asked. A dozen small things that had bothered me over the past few days suddenly clicked together. Why had Apophis only scared Carter in the Brooklyn Museum when the arrows of Sekhmet could have destroyed him? How had we escaped so easily from St. Petersburg? Why had Set volunteered the location of the third scroll? Apophis wants chaos, I said. He wants to divide his enemies. If Ra comes back, it could throw us into a civil war. The magicians are already divided. The gods would be fighting each other. There would be no clear ruler. And if Ra isn't reborn in a strong new form, if he's as old and feeble as I saw in my vision, so we shouldn't awaken Ra? Walt asked. That's not the answer either, I said. Bast tilted her head. I'm confused. My mind was racing. Katrina the camel was still chewing on my hair, turning it into a slimy mess, but I hardly noticed. We have to stick to the plan. We need Ra. Mart and Chaos have to balance, right? If Apophis rises, Ra has to as well. Walt twisted his rings. But if Apophis wants Ra awakened, if he thinks it will help him destroy the world, we have to believe Apophis is wrong. I remembered something Jazzy's Wren had told me. We choose to believe in Mart. Apophis can't imagine that anyone could unite the gods and magicians, I said. He thinks the return of Ra will weaken us even further. We have to prove him wrong. We have to make order from chaos. That's what Egypt has always done. It's a risk, a huge risk, but if we do nothing because we fear we'll fail, we play right into Apophis's hands. It's hard to give a rousing speech with a camel licking your head, but Walt nodded. The cat didn't look quite so enthusiastic. Then again, cats rarely do.
Don't underestimate Apophis, Bast said. You haven't fought him. I have.
Which is why we need you back quickly. I told her about Vlad Menshikov's conversation with Set and his plans to destroy Brooklyn House. Bast, our friends are in terrible danger. Menshikov is possibly even more insane than Amos realizes. As soon as you're able, go to Brooklyn. I have a feeling our last stand is going to be there. We'll get the third scroll and find Ra.
I don't like last stands, the cat said, but you're right. It sounds bad. By the way, where are Bess and Carter?
She looked suspiciously at the camels.
You didn't turn them into those, did you?
The idea is appealing, I said, but no. I told her briefly what Carter was up to. Bast hissed with distaste.
A foolish detour. I'll have words with that dwarf about letting you go off on your own.
What am I, invisible? Walt protested.
Sorry, dear, I didn't mean...
The cat's eyes twitched. It coughed like it had a hairball.
My connection is failing. Good luck, Sadie. The best entrance to the tombs is on a small date farm just to the southeast. Look for a black water tower, and do watch out for the Romans. They're quite...
The cat puffed up its tail. Then it blinked and looked around in confusion. What Romans? I asked. They're quite what? The cat stared at me with an expression that said... Who are you and where is the food? I swatted the camel's nose away from my slimy hair. Come on, Walt, I grumbled. Let's go find some mummies. We provided the cat with bits of beef jerky and some water from our supplies. It wasn't as good as fish and milk, but the cat seemed happy enough. As it was in sight of the oasis, and obviously knew its way around better than we did, we left it to finish its meal. Walt turned the camels back into amulets, thank goodness, and we trudged into Baharia on foot. The date farm wasn't difficult to find. The black water tower sat at the edge of the property, and it was the tallest structure in sight. We made our way toward it, weaving through acres of palm trees, which provided some shade from the sun. An adobe farmhouse stood in the distance, but we didn't see any people. Probably the Egyptians knew better than to be out in the afternoon heat. When we reached the water tower, I didn't see any obvious tomb entrance. The tower looked quite old, four rusty steel posts holding a round tank the size of a garage about 15 meters in the air. The tank had a slow leak. Every few seconds, water dropped from the sky and smacked against the hard-packed sand underneath. There wasn't much else in sight except for more palm trees, a few tarnished farm tools, and a weathered plywood sign lying on the ground. The sign was spray-painted in Arabic and English, probably from some attempt by the farmer to sell his wares in the market. The English read, "Dates, best price, cold Bebsi." "Bebsi?" I asked. "Pepsi," Walt said. "I read about that on the internet. There's no P in Arabic. Everyone here calls soda Bebsi." "So you have to have Bebsi with your pizza?" "Probably," I snorted. "If this is a famous dig site, shouldn't there be more activity? Archaeologists, ticket booths, souvenir merchants?"
"Maybe Bast sent us to a secret entrance," Walt said. "Better than sneaking past a bunch of guards and caretakers."
A secret entrance sounded quite intriguing, but unless the water tower was a magic teleporter or one of the date trees had a concealed door, I wasn't sure where this oh-so-helpful entrance might be. I kicked the Bebsi sign. There was nothing underneath except more sand slowly turning to mud from the drip, drip, drip of the leaky tower. Then I looked more closely at the wet spot on the ground. "Hang on," I knelt. The water was pooling in a little canal, as if the sand was seeping into a subterranean crack. The crevice was about a meter long and no wider than a pencil, but much too straight to be natural. I dug in the sand. 6 centimeters down, my fingernails scraped stone. "Help me clear this," I told Walt. A minute later, we'd uncovered a flat paving stone about 1 meter square. I tried to work my fingers under the wet edges, but the stone was too thick and much too heavy to lift. "We can use something as a lever," Walt suggested. "Pry it up." "Or," I said, "stand back." Walt looked ready to protest, but when I brought out my staff, he knew enough to get out of the way. With my new understanding of godly magic, I didn't so much think about what I needed as feel a connection to Isis. I remembered a time when she'd found her husband's coffin grown into the trunk of a cypress tree, and in her anger and desperation she blew the tree apart. I channeled those emotions and pointed at the stone. "Hardy!" Good news? The spell worked even better than in St. Petersburg. The hieroglyph glowed at the end of my staff, and the stone was blasted to rubble, revealing a dark hole underneath. Bad news? That's not all I destroyed. Around the hole, the ground began to crumble. Walt and I scrambled backward as more stones fell into the pit, and I realized I'd just destabilized the entire roof of a subterranean room. The hole widened until it reached the support legs of the water tower. The water tower began to creak and sway. "Run!" Walt yelled. We didn't stop until we were hiding behind a palm tree 30 meters away. The water tower sprang 100 different leaks, wobbled back and forth like a drunken man, then fell toward us and shattered, soaking us from head to toe and sending a flood through the rows of palm trees. The noise was so deafening it must have been heard throughout the oasis. "Oops," I said. Walt looked at me like I was mad. I suppose I was guilty as charged, but it's just so bloody tempting to blow things up, isn't it? We ran to the Sadie Kane Memorial Crater. It was now the size of a swimming pool. 5 meters down, under a pile of sand and rocks, were rows of mummies, all wrapped in old cloth and laid out on stone slabs. The mummies were now flattened, I'm afraid, but I could tell they'd been brightly painted with red, blue, and gold. Golden mummies.
Walt looked horrified. Part of the tomb system that hasn't been excavated yet. You just ruined...
I did say oops. Now, help me down there before the owner of this water tower shows up with a shotgun.
16. But not as evil as Romans. To be fair, the mummies in that particular room were mostly ruined already, thanks to the moisture from the leaking tower above. Just add water to mummies for a truly horrible smell. We climbed over the rubble and found a corridor leading deeper underground. I couldn't tell whether it was natural or man-made, but it snaked for a good 40 meters through solid rock before opening into another burial chamber. This room had not been damaged by water. Everything was remarkably well preserved. Walt had brought torches, flashlights for you Americans, and in the dim light on stone slabs and in niches carved along the walls, gold-painted mummies glittered. There were at least 100 in this room alone, and more corridors led off in each direction. Walt shined his light on 3 mummies lying together on a central dais. Their bodies were completely wrapped in linen, so they looked rather like bowling pins. Their likenesses were painted on the linen in meticulous detail, hands crossed over their chests, jewellery adorning their necks, Egyptian kilt and sandals, and a host of protective hieroglyphs and images of the gods in a border on each side. All this was typical Egyptian art, but their faces were done in a completely different style, realistic portraits that looked cut and pasted onto the mummies' heads. On the left was a man with a thin, bearded face and sad, dark eyes. On the right was a beautiful woman with curly auburn hair. What really pulled at my heart, though, was the mummy in the middle. Its body was tiny, obviously a child. Its portrait showed a boy of about 7 years old. He had the man's eyes and the woman's hair. A family, Walt guessed, buried together. There was something tucked under the child's right elbow, a small wooden horse, possibly his favourite toy. Even though this family had been dead for thousands of years, I couldn't help getting a bit teary-eyed. It was so bloody sad. How did they die? I wondered. From the corridor directly in front of us, a voice echoed,
"The wasting disease."
My staff was instantly in my hand. Walt trained his torch on the doorway, and a ghost stepped into the room. At least I assumed he was a ghost, because he was see-through. He was a heavy, older man with short-cropped white hair, bulldog jowls, and a cross expression. He wore Roman-style robes and coal eyeliner, so he looked rather like Winston Churchill, if the old Prime Minister had thrown a wild toga party and gotten his face painted.
"Newly dead?"
he eyed us warily.
"Haven't seen any new arrivals in a long time. Where are your bodies?"
Walt and I glanced at each other. "Actually," I said, "we're wearing them." The ghost's eyebrows shot up.
"De immortalis! You're alive?"
"So far," Walt said.
"Then you've brought offerings?"
The man rubbed his hands.
"Oh, they said you would come, but we've waited ages. Where have you been?"
I didn't want to disappoint a ghost, especially as he was beginning to glow more brightly, which in magic is often a prelude to exploding. "Perhaps we should introduce ourselves. I'm Sadie Kane. This is Walt..."
"Of course. You need my name for the spells."
The ghost cleared his throat.
"I am Appius Claudius Eratus."
I got the feeling I was supposed to be impressed. "Right, that's not Egyptian, I gather." The ghost looked offended.
"Roman, of course. Following those cursed Egyptian customs is how we all ended up here to begin with. Bad enough I got stationed in this godforsaken oasis, as if Rome needs an entire legion to guard some date farms. Then I had the bad luck to fall ill. Told my wife on my deathbed, 'Lobelia, an old-fashioned Roman burial, none of this local nonsense.' But no, she never listened. Had to mummify me so my Bar is stuck here forever. Women. She probably moved back to Rome and died in the proper way.
Lobelia? I asked, because really I hadn't heard much after that. What sort of parents name their child Lobelia? The ghost huffed and crossed his arms.
But you don't want to hear me ramble on, do you? You may call me Mad Claude. That's the translation in your tongue.
I wondered how a Roman ghost could speak English, or if I simply understood him through some sort of telepathy. Either way, I was not relieved to find out his name was Mad Claude. Walt raised his hand. Are you mad as in angry, or mad as in crazy?
Yes, Claude said. Now, about those offerings. I see staffs, wands, and amulets, so I assume you're priests with the local House of Life. Good, good. Then you'll know what to do.
What to do? I agreed heartily. Yes, quite. Claude's eyes narrowed.
Oh, Jupiter, you're novices, aren't you? Did the temple even explain the problem to you?
He stormed over to the family of mummies we'd been looking at.
This is Lucius, Flavia, and little Perpens. They died of the wasting plague. I've been here so long I could tell you practically everyone's story.
They talk to you? I stepped away from the mummy family. Suddenly little Perpens didn't seem so cute. Mad Claude waved his hand impatiently.
Sometimes, yes. Not as much as in the old days. Their spirits sleep most of the time now. The point is, no matter how bad a death these people had, their fate after death has been worse. All of us, all these Romans living in Egypt, got an Egyptian burial. Local customs, local priests mummify the bodies for the next life, etc. We thought we were covering our bases. Two religions, twice the insurance. Problem was, you foolish Egyptian priests didn't know what you were doing anymore. By the time we Romans came along, most of your magic knowledge was lost. But did you tell us that? No. You were happy to take our coins and do a shoddy job.
Ah, I backed away a bit more from Mad Claude, who was now glowing quite dangerously. Well, I'm sure the House of Life has a customer service number for that.
You can't go halfway with these Egyptian rituals, he grumbled. We ended up with mummified bodies and eternal souls tethered to them, and no one followed up. No one said the prayers to help us move to the next life. No one made offerings to nourish our bars. Do you know how hungry I am?
We've got some beef jerky, Walt offered.
We couldn't go to Pluto's realm like good Romans, Mad Claude went on, because our bodies had been prepared for a different afterlife. We couldn't go to the Duat because we weren't given the proper Egyptian rituals. Our souls were stuck here, attached to these bodies. Do you have any idea how boring it is down here?
So, if you're a bar, I asked, why don't you have a bird's body?
I told you. We're all mixed up. Not pure Roman ghost, not proper bar. If I had wings, believe me, I'd fly out of here. By the way, what year is it? Who's the emperor now?
Oh, his name is... Walt coughed, then rushed on. You know, Claude, I'm sure we can help you. We can? I said. Oh, right, we can. Walt nodded encouragingly. The thing is, we have to find something first. A scroll, I put in. Part of the Book of Ra. Claude scratched his considerable jowls.
And this will help you send our souls to the next life?
Well, I said. Yes, Walt said. Possibly, I said. We don't really know until we find it. It's supposed to wake Ra, you see, which will help the Egyptian gods. I'd think that would improve your chances at getting into the afterlife. Besides, I'm on good terms with the Egyptian gods. They pop over for tea from time to time. If you helped us, I could put in a word. Honestly, I'd just been making up things to say. I'm sure this will surprise you, but I sometimes ramble when I get nervous. Oh, stop laughing, Carter.
At any rate, Mad Claude's expression became shrewder. He studied us as if assessing our bank accounts. I wondered if the Roman Empire had used chariot salesmen, and if Mad Claude had been one. I imagined him on a Roman commercial in a cheap plaid toga.
"I must be crazy to be giving away chariots at these prices."
"On good terms with the Egyptian gods," he mused.
"Put in a word, you say?"
Then he turned to Walt. Claude's expression was so calculating, so eager, it made my skin crawl.
"If the scroll you seek is ancient, it would be in the oldest section of the catacombs. Some natives were buried there, you know, long before we Romans came along. Their bars have all moved on now. No trouble getting into the Duat for them, but their burial sites are still intact. Lots of relics and so on."
"You'd be willing to show us?" Walt asked, with much more excitement than I could have managed.
"Oh, yes."
Mad Claude gave us his best used chariot salesman smile.
"And later we'll talk about an appropriate fee, eh? Come along, my friends, it's not far."
Note to self. When a ghost offers to guide you deeper into a burial site and his name includes the word mad, it's best to say no. As we passed through tunnels and chambers, Mad Claude gave us a running commentary on the various mummies. Caligula, the date merchant.
"Horrible name, but once you're named for an emperor, even a psychotic one, you can't do much about it. He died betting someone he could kiss a scorpion."
Varennes, the slaver.
"Disgusting man. Tried to go into the gladiator business. If you give a slave a sword, well, you can guess how he died."
Octavia, the legion commander's wife.
"Went completely native. Had her cat mummified. She even believed she had the blood of the pharaohs and tried to channel the spirit of Isis. Her death, needless to say, was painful."
He grinned at me like this was extremely funny. I tried not to look horrified. What struck me most was the sheer number and variety of the mummies. Some were wrapped in real gold. Their portraits were so lifelike. Their eyes seemed to follow me as we passed. They sat on ornately carved marble slabs, surrounded by valuables, jewelry, vases, even some shapti. Other mummies looked as if nursery school children had made them in art class. They were crudely wrapped, painted with shaky hieroglyphs and little stick figure gods. Their portraits were not much better than I could have done, which is to say, dreadful. Their bodies were stuffed 3 deep in shallow niches, or simply piled in the corners of the room. When I asked about them, Mad Claude was dismissive.
"Commoners, wannabes, didn't have money for artists and funeral rites, so they tried the do-it-yourself approach."
I looked down at the portrait of the nearest mummy, her face a crude finger-painted image. I wondered if her grieving children had made it, one last gift for their mother. Despite the bad quality, I found it rather sweet. They had no money and no artistic skill, but they'd done their best to lovingly send her to the afterlife. Next time I saw Anubis, I would ask him about this. A woman like that deserved a chance at happiness in the next world, even if she couldn't pay. We had quite enough snobbery in this world without exporting it to the hereafter. Walt trailed behind us, not speaking. He'd shine his light on this mummy or that, as if pondering each one's fate. I wondered if he was thinking of King Tut, his famous ancestor, whose tomb had been in a cavern not too different from this. After several more long tunnels and crowded mummy rooms, we arrived in a burial chamber that was clearly much older. The wall paintings had faded, but they looked more authentically Egyptian, with the sideways walking people and hieroglyphs that actually formed words rather than simply providing decoration. Instead of realistic facial portraits, the mummies had the generic, wide-eyed, smiling faces I'd seen on most Egyptian death masks. A few had crumbled to dust. Others were encased in stone sarcophagi.
"Natives," Mad Claude confirmed. "Egyptian nobles from before Rome took over. What you're looking for should be somewhere in this area."
I scanned the room. The only other doorway was blocked with boulders and debris. While Walt began searching, I remembered what Bess had said, that the first two scrolls of Ra might help me find the third. I pulled them from my bag, hoping they would point the way like a dowsing rod, but nothing happened. From the other side of the room, Walt called, "What's this?" He was standing in front of some sort of shrine, a niche set into the wall, with the statue of a man wrapped like a mummy. The figure was carved from wood, decorated with jewels and precious metals. His wrappings glistened like pearl in the light of the torch. He held a golden staff with a silver Jed symbol on top. Around his feet stood several golden rodents, rats perhaps. The skin of his face gleamed turquoise blue. "It's my dad," I guessed. Osiris, isn't it?" Mad Claude arched his eyebrows.
"Your dad?"
Fortunately, Walt saved me from explaining. "No," he said. "Look at his beard." The statue's beard was rather unusual. It was pencil-thin from his sideburns around his jawline, with a perfectly straight bit coming down for a goatee, as if someone had traced the beard with a grease pen, then stuck the pen on his chin. "And the collar," Walt continued. "It's got a tassel thing hanging down in back. You don't see that with Osiris. And those animals at his feet, are those rats? I remember some story about rats."
"I thought you were priests," Mad Claude grumped. "Obviously, the god is Ptah."
"Ptah?" I'd heard quite a few odd Egyptian god names, but this was a new one for me. "Ptah, son of Ptui? Is he the god of spitting?" Claude glared at me.
"Are you always so irreverent?"
"Usually more."
"A novice and a heretic," he said. "Just my luck. Well, girl, I shouldn't have to teach you about your own gods, but as I understand it, Ptah was the god of craftsmen. We compared him to our Roman god Vulcan."
"Then what's he doing in a tomb?" Walt asked. Claude scratched his non-existent head.
"I've never been sure, actually. You don't see him in most Egyptian funeral rites."
Walt pointed to the statue's staff. When I looked more closely, I realized the Jed symbol was combined with something else, a curved top that looked strangely familiar.
"That's the symbol Was," Walt said. "It means power. Lots of the gods had staffs like that, but I never realized it looks like..."
"Yes, yes," Claude said impatiently. "The priest's ceremonial knife for opening the mouth of the dead. Honestly, you Egyptian priests are hopeless. No wonder we conquered you so easily."
My hand acted quite on its own, reaching into my bag and bringing out the black Nijiri blade Anubis had given me. Mad Claude's eyes glinted.
"Ah, so you're not hopeless. That's perfect. With that knife and the proper spell, you should be able to touch my mummy and release me into the Duat."
"No," I said. "No, there's more to it. The knife, the Book of Ra, this statue of the Spit God, it all fits together somehow." Walt's face lit up.
"Sadie, Ptah was more than the craftsman god, right? Didn't they call him the god of opening?"
Possibly.
"I thought you taught us that. Or maybe it was Carter."
"Boring bit of information? Probably Carter."
"But it's important," Walt insisted. "Ptah was a creation god. In some legends, he created the souls of mankind just by speaking a word. He could revive any soul and open any door."
My eyes drifted to the debris-filled doorway, the only other exit from the room. "Open any door?" I held up the two scrolls of Ra and walked toward the collapsed tunnel. The scrolls became uncomfortably warm.
"The last scroll is on the other side," I said. "We need to get past this rubble."
I held the black knife in one hand and the scrolls in the other. I spoke the command for open. Nothing happened. I went back to the statue of Ptah and tried the same thing. No luck.
"Hello, Ptah," I called. "Sorry about the spit comment. Look, we're trying to get the third scroll of Ra, which is on the other side there. I suppose you were placed here to open a path, so would you mind terribly?"
Still, nothing happened. Mad Claude gripped the trim of his toga as if he wanted to strangle us with it.
Look, I don't know why you need this scroll to free us if you've got the knife, but why don't you try an offering? All gods need offerings.
Walt rummaged through his supplies. He placed a juice pouch and a bit of beef jerky at the foot of the statue. The statue did nothing. Even the gold rats at his feet apparently didn't want our beef jerky. Bloody spit god! I threw myself down on the dusty ground. I had a mummy on either side of me, but I didn't care any more. I couldn't believe we were so close to the last scroll after fighting demons, gods, and Russian assassins, and now we'd been stopped by a pile of rocks.
I hate to suggest it, Walt said, but you could blast through with the Hadi spell.
And bring down the ceiling on top of us, I said.
You'd die, Claude agreed, which isn't an experience I'd recommend.
Walt knelt next to me.
There's got to be something.
He took stock of his amulets. Mad Claude paced the room.
I still don't understand. You're priests. You have the ceremonial knife. Why can't you release us?
The knife isn't for you, I snapped. It's for Ra. Walt and Claude both stared at me. I hadn't realized it before, but as soon as I spoke, I knew it was the truth.
Sorry, I said. But the knife is used for the opening of the mouth ceremony to free a soul. I'll need it to awaken Ra. That's why Anubis gave it to me.
You know Anubis?
Claude clapped with delight.
He can free us all. And you,
he pointed at Walt,
you're one of Anubis's chosen, aren't you? You can get us more knives if you need them. I sensed the presence of the god around you as soon as we met. Did you take his service when he realized you were dying?
Wait. What? I asked. Walt wouldn't meet my eyes.
I'm not a priest of Anubis.
But dying? I choked up. How are you dying? Mad Claude looked incredulous.
You mean you don't know? He's got the old pharaoh's curse. We didn't see it much in my day, but I recognize it all right. Occasionally a person from one of the old Egyptian royal lines...
Claude, shut up, I said. Walt, speak. How does this curse work?
In the dim light, he looked thinner and older. On the wall behind him, his shadow loomed like a deformed monster.
Akhenaten's curse runs in my family, he said. Kind of a genetic disease. Not every generation, not every person, but when it strikes, it's bad. Tut died at 19. Most of the others, 12, 13. I'm 16 now. My dad was 18. I never knew him.
18? That alone brought up a host of new questions, but I tried to stay focused. Can't it be cured? Guilt washed over me, and I felt like a total imbecile. Oh, God! That's why you were talking to Jazz. She's a healer.
Walt nodded grimly. I thought she might know spells that I hadn't been able to find. My dad's family, they spent years searching. My mom has been looking for a cure since I was born. The doctors in Seattle couldn't do anything.
Doctors, Mad Claude said with disgust. I had one in the Legion, loved to put leeches on my legs, only made me worse. Now, about this connection to Anubis and using that knife?
Walt shook his head.
Claude, we'll try to help you, but not with the knife. I know magic items. I'm pretty sure it can be used only once, and we can't just make another. If Sadie needs it for Ra, she can't risk using it before that.
Excuses! Claude roared.
If you don't shut up, I warned, I'm going to find your mummy and draw a moustache on your portrait. Claude turned as white as, well, a ghost.
You wouldn't dare!
Walt, I said, trying to ignore the Roman, was Jazz able to help?
She tried her best, but this curse has been defying healers for 3,000 years. Modern doctors think it's related to sickle cell anemia, but they don't know. They've been trying for decades to figure out how King Tut died, and they can't agree. Some say poison, some say a genetic disease. It's the curse, but of course they can't say that.
Isn't there any way? I mean, we know gods. Perhaps I could cure you, like Isis did Ra. If I knew your secret name...
Sadie, I've thought of that. He said, I've thought of everything. The curse can't be cured. It can only be slowed down if... if I avoid magic. That's why I got into talismans and amulets. They store magic in advance, so they don't require as much from the user. But it's only helped a little bit. I was born to do magic, so the curse progresses in me no matter what I do. Some days it's not so bad. Some days my whole body is in pain. When I do magic, it gets worse. And the more you do, the faster I die.
I punched him in the chest. I couldn't help it. All my grief and guilt flipped right to anger. You idiot! Why are you here, then? You should have told me to shove off. Bess warned you to stay in Brooklyn. Why didn't you listen? What I told you earlier about Walt's eyes not melting me? I take it back. When he looked at me in that dusty tomb, his eyes were every bit as dark, tender, and sad as Anubis's. I'm going to die anyway, Sadie. I want my life to mean something, and I want to spend as much time as I can with you. That hurt me worse than a punch in the chest, much worse. I think I might have kissed him, or possibly slapped him. Mad Claude, however, was not a sympathetic audience.
Very sweet, I'm sure, but you promised me payment. Come back to the Roman tombs, release my spirit from my mummy, then release the others. After that, you can do as you like.
The others? I asked. Are you mad? He stared at me. Silly question, I conceded. But there are thousands of mummies. We have one knife.
You promised!
We did not, I said. You said we'd discuss a fee after we found the scroll. We've found nothing but a dead end here. The ghost growled, more like a wolf than a human.
If you won't come to us, he said, we'll come to you.
His spirit glowed, then disappeared in a flash. I looked nervously at Walt. What did he mean by that?
I don't know, he said. But we should figure out how to get through that rubble and get out of here. Quickly.
Despite our best efforts, nothing happened quickly. We couldn't move the debris. There were too many large boulders. We couldn't dig around, over, or under it. I didn't dare risk a hardy spell or use the Black Knife's magic. Walt had no amulets that would help. I was frankly stumped. The statue of Ptah smiled at us, but didn't offer any helpful suggestions, nor did he seem interested in the beef jerky and juice. Finally, covered with dust, drenched with sweat, I plopped down on a stone sarcophagus and examined my blistered fingers. Walt sat next to me. Don't give up. There has to be a way. Does there? I asked, feeling especially resentful. Like there has to be a cure for you? What if there isn't? What if... My voice broke. Walt turned his face so it was hidden in shadow. I'm sorry, I said. That was terrible, but I just couldn't stand it if... I was so confused, I didn't know what to say or how I felt. All I knew is that I didn't want to lose Walt. Did you mean it? I asked. When you said you wanted to spend time... you know... Walt shrugged.
Isn't it obvious?
I didn't answer, but please, nothing is obvious with boys. For such simple creatures, they are quite baffling. I imagined I was blushing fiercely, so I decided to change the subject. Claude said he sensed the spirit of Anubis about you. You've been talking to Anubis a lot? Walt turned his rings.
I thought maybe he could help me, maybe grant me a little extra time before the end. I wanted to be around long enough to help you defeat Apophis. Then I'd feel like I did something with my life. And there were other reasons I wanted to talk to him. About some powers I've been developing.
What sort of powers?
It was Walt's turn to change the subject. He looked at his hands like they'd become dangerous weapons. The thing is, I almost didn't come to Brooklyn. When I got the Jed amulet, that calling card you guys sent, my mom didn't want me to leave. She knew that learning magic would make the curse accelerate. Part of me was afraid to go. Part of me was angry. It seemed like a cruel joke.
You guys offered to train me for magic when I knew I wouldn't survive longer than a year or two.
A year or two?
I could hardly breathe. I'd always thought of a year as an incredibly long time. I'd waited forever to turn 13, and each school term seemed like an eternity. But suddenly, 2 years seemed much too short. I'd only be 15, not even driving yet. I couldn't imagine what it would be like to know that I would die in 2 years, possibly sooner if I continued doing what I was born to do, practicing magic.
Why did you come to Brooklyn, then?
I had to, Walt said. I've lived my whole life under the threat of death. My mom made everything so serious, so huge. But when I got to Brooklyn, I felt like I had a destiny, a purpose. Even if it made the curse more painful, it was worth it.
But it's so bloody unfair.
Walt looked at me, and I realized he was smiling. That's my line. I've been saying that for years. Sadie, I want to be here. The past 2 months, I've felt like I'm actually living for the first time. And getting to know you... He cleared his throat. He was quite attractive when he got nervous. I started worrying about small things. My hair, my clothes, whether I brushed my teeth. I mean, I'm dying and I'm worrying about my teeth.
You have lovely teeth.
He laughed. That's what I mean. A little comment like that and I feel better. All these small things suddenly seem important. I don't feel like I'm dying. I feel happy. Personally, I felt miserable. For months I dreamed about Walt admitting he liked me, but not like this. Not like I can be honest with you because I'm dying anyway. Something he'd said was nagging at me, too. It reminded me of a lesson I'd taught at Brooklyn House, and an idea began to form in my mind. Small things suddenly seem important, I repeated. I looked down at a little mound of rubble we'd cleared from the blocked doorway.
Oh! Couldn't be that easy.
What? Asked Walt.
Rocks!
I just bared my soul, and you're thinking about rocks?
The doorway, I said. Sympathetic magic. Do you think...
He blinked. Sadie Kane, you're a genius.
Well, I know that, but can we make it work?
Walt and I began gathering up more pebbles. We chipped some pieces from the larger boulders and added them to our pile. We tried our best to make a miniature replica of the rubble collection blocking the doorway. My hope, of course, was to create a sympathetic bond, as I'd done with Carter and the wax figurine in Alexandria. The rocks in our replica pile came from the collapsed tunnel, so our pile and the original were already connected in substance, which should have made it easy to establish a link. But moving something very large with something very small is always tricky. If we didn't do it carefully, we could collapse the whole room. I didn't know how deep underground we were, but I imagined there was quite enough rock and dirt over our heads to bury us forever.
Ready?
I asked. Walt nodded and pulled out his wand. Oh, no, cursed boy, I said. You just watch my back. If the ceiling starts to fall and we need a shield, that's your job. But you'll do no magic unless absolutely necessary. I'll clear the doorway.
Sadie, I'm not fragile, he complained. I don't need a protector.
Rubbish, I said. That's macho bluster, and all boys like to be mothered.
What? God, you're annoying.
I smiled sweetly.
You did want to spend time with me.
Before he could protest, I raised my wand and began the spell. I imagined a bond between our small pile of rubble and the debris in the doorway. I imagined that in the duat they were one and the same. I spoke the command for join.
Heinim!
The symbol burned faintly over our miniature rubble pile. Slowly and carefully, I brushed a few pebbles away from the pile. The debris in the corridor rumbled.
It's working, Walt said. I didn't dare look. I stayed focused on my task, moving the pebbles a little at a time, dispersing the pile into smaller mounds. It was almost as hard as moving real boulders. I went into a daze.
When Walt put his hand on my shoulder, I had no idea how much time had passed. I was so exhausted I couldn't see straight.
It's done, he said. You did great.
The doorway was clear. The rubble had been pushed into the corners of our room, where it lay in smaller piles.
Nice job, Sadie.
Walt leaned down and kissed me. He was probably just expressing appreciation or happiness, but the kiss didn't make me feel any less fuzzy-headed. I said, again with the incredible verbal skills. Walt helped me to my feet. We headed down the corridor into the next room. For all the work we'd done to get there, the room wasn't very exciting. Just a 5-meter square chamber with nothing inside except a red lacquered box on a sandstone pedestal. On top of the box was a carved wooden handle shaped like a demonic greyhound with tall ears, the set animal. "Oh, that can't be good," Walt said. But I walked straight up to the box, opened the lid, and grabbed the scroll inside. "Sadie!" Walt yelled. "What?" I turned. "It's Set's box. If he'd wanted to kill me, he could have done so in St. Petersburg. He wants me to have this scroll. Probably thinks it'll be fun watching me kill myself trying to awaken Ra." I looked up at the ceiling and shouted, "Isn't that right, Set?" My voice echoed through the catacombs. I no longer had the power to invoke Set's secret name, but I still felt as if I'd gotten his attention. The air turned sharper, the ground trembled as if something underneath it, something very large, was laughing. Walt exhaled. "I wish you wouldn't take chances like that." "This from a boy who's willing to die to spend time with me?" Walt made an exaggerated bow. "I take it back, Miss Kane. Please go right ahead trying to kill yourself." "Thank you." I looked at the 3 scrolls in my hands, the entire Book of Ra, together for probably the first time since Mad Claude wore little Roman diapers. I had collected the scrolls, done the impossible, triumphed beyond all expectations. Yet it still wouldn't be enough unless we could find Ra and wake him before Apophis rose. "No time to waste," I said. "Let's get..." Deep moaning echoed through the corridors, as if something, or a whole host of somethings, had woken up in a very bad mood. "Out of here," Walt said. "Great idea." As we ran through the previous chamber, I glanced at the statue of Ptah. I was tempted to take back the jerky and juice just to be mean, but I decided against it. "I suppose it isn't your fault," I thought. "Can't be easy to have a name like Ptah. Enjoy the snack, but I do wish you'd helped us." We ran on. It wasn't easy to remember our path. Twice we had to double back before finding the room with the family of mummies where we'd met Mad Claude. I was about to bolt blindly across the chamber and into the last tunnel, but Walt held me back and saved my life. He shined his light on the far exit, then on the corridors to either side. "No," I said. "No, no, no." All 3 doorways were clogged with human figures wrapped in linen. They pressed together as far as I could see down each corridor. Some were still completely bound. They hopped and shuffled and waddled forward as if they were giant cocoons engaged in a sack race. Other mummies had partially broken free. They limped along on emaciated legs, hands like dried branches clawing at their wrappings. Most still wore their painted face portraits, and the effect was gruesome. Lifelike masks smiling serenely at the top of undead scarecrows of bones and painted linen. "I hate mummies," I whimpered. "Maybe a fire spell," Walt said. "They've got to burn easily." "We'll burn ourselves, too. It's too close in here. You have a better idea?" I wanted to cry. Freedom so near, and just as I'd feared, we were trapped by a crowd of mummies. But these were worse than movie mummies. They were silent and slow, pathetic, ruined things that once were human. One of the mummies on the floor grabbed my leg. Before I could even scream, Walt reached out and tapped the thing on the wrist. The mummy instantly turned to dust. I stared at him in amazement. "Is that the power you were worried about? That was brilliant! Do it again!" Immediately I felt awful suggesting it. Walt's face was tight with pain. "I can't do it 1,000 more times," he said sadly. "Maybe if..." Then, on the central dais, the mummy family began to stir. "I will not lie. When the child-sized mummy of little Perpens sat up, I almost had an accident that would have ruined my new jeans. If my bar could have shed my skin and flown away, it would have." I gripped Walt's arm.
At the far end of the room, the ghost of Mad Claude flickered into view. As he walked toward us, the rest of the mummies began to stir.
"You should be honored, my friends."
He gave us a crazy grin.
"It takes a lot of excitement for Ba'a to return to their withered old bodies. But we simply can't let you leave until you've freed us for the afterlife. Use the knife, do your spells, and you can go."
"We can't free you all," I shouted.
"A shame," Claude said. "Then we'll take the knife and free ourselves. I suppose two more bodies in the catacombs won't make any difference."
He said something in Latin, and all the mummies surged toward us, shuffling and tripping, falling and rolling. Some crumbled to pieces as they tried to walk. Others fell down and were trampled by their fellows, but more came forward. We backed into the corridor. I had my staff in one hand. With my other, I held tight to Walt's hand. I'd never been good at summoning fire, but I managed to set the end of my staff ablaze. "We'll try it your way," I told Walt. "Light them up and run." I knew it was a bad idea. In close quarters, a blaze would hurt us as much as the mummies. We'd die of smoke inhalation or suffocation or heat. Even if we managed to retreat back into the catacombs, we'd just get lost and run into more mummies. Walt lit his own staff. "On three," I suggested. I stared in horror at the child's mummy coming toward us, the portrait of a 7-year-old boy smiling at me from beyond the grave. "One, two..." I faltered. The mummies were only a meter away, but from behind me came a new sound, like water running. No, like skittering. A mass of living things charging toward us, thousands and thousands of tiny claws on stone, possibly insects or... "Three comes next," Walt said nervously. "Are we torching them or not?" "Hug the walls!" I shrieked. I didn't know exactly what was coming, but I knew I didn't want to be in their way. I pushed Walt against the stone and flattened myself next to him, our faces pressed against the wall, as a wave of claws and fur slammed into us and rolled over our backs. An army of rodents scuttling 5 deep along the floor and racing horizontally across the walls, defying gravity. Rats! Thousands of rats! They ran straight over us, doing no damage except for the odd claw scratch. Not so bad, you might think, but have you ever been upright and trampled by an army of filthy rats? Do not pay money for the experience. The rats flooded the burial chamber. They tore into the mummies, clawing and chewing and squealing their tiny battle cries. The mummies writhed under the assault, but they didn't stand a chance. The room was a hurricane of fur, teeth and shredded linen. It was like the old cartoons of termites swarming over wood and dissolving it to nothing. "No!" yelled Mad Claude. "No!" But he was the only one screaming. The mummies withered silently under the fury of the rats.
"I'll get you," Claude snarled as his spirit began to flicker. "I'll have my revenge."
And with one final evil glare, his image faded and was gone. The rats divided their forces and scurried off down all 3 corridors, chewing through mummies as they went, until the room was silent and empty, the floor littered with dust, shreds of linen, and a few bones. Walt looked shaken. I fell against him and hugged him. I probably cried with relief. I was so glad to hold a warm, living human being. "It's okay." He stroked my hair, which felt awfully good. That was the story about rats.
What?
I managed. They saved Memphis. An enemy army besieged the city, and the people prayed for help. Their patron god sent a horde of rats. They ate the enemy's bowstrings, their sandals, everything they could chew. The attackers had to withdraw.
The patron god? You mean...
me.
From the exit corridor across the room, an Egyptian farmer stepped into view. He wore grubby robes, a head wrap, and sandals. He held a rifle at his side. He grinned at us, and as he got closer, I saw his eyes were blank white. His skin had a slightly bluish tint, as if he were suffocating and really enjoying the experience.
"Sorry I didn't answer sooner,"
said the farmer. I am Ptah. And no, Sadie Kane, I am not the god of spit. Please, have a seat, the god said. Sorry about the mess, but what do you expect from Romans? They never did clean up after themselves.
Neither Walt nor I sat. A grinning god with a rifle was a bit off-putting.
Ah, quite right. Ptah blinked his blank white eyes. You're in a hurry.
Sorry, I said. Are you a date farmer?
Ptah looked down at his grubby robes. I'm just borrowing this poor fellow for a minute, you understand. I thought you wouldn't mind, as he was coming down here to shoot you for destroying his water tower.
No, carry on, I said. But the mummies, what will happen to their bar?
Ptah laughed. Don't worry about them. Now that their remains are destroyed, I imagine their bar will go on to whatever Roman afterlife awaits them. As it should be.
He put his hand over his mouth and burped. A cloud of white gas billowed out, coalesced into a glowing bar, and flew off down the corridor. Walt pointed after the spirit bird.
Did you just... Yes, Ptah sighed. I rarely try not to talk at all. That's how I create, you see, with words. They can get me into trouble. Once, just for fun, I made up the word platypus, and instantly a duck-billed furry thing appeared on the floor, scrabbling around in a panic.
Oh, dear, Ptah said. Yes, that's exactly what happened. Slip of the tongue.
Really, the only way something like that could have been created.
He waved his hand and the platypus disappeared.
At any rate, I have to be careful, so I can't talk long. I'm glad you found the Book of Ra. I always did like the old chap. I would have helped earlier when you asked, but it took a while to get here from the Duat. Also, I can open only one door per customer. I thought you had that blocked corridor well in hand, but there's a much more important door that you need.
Sorry?
I asked. Your brother, Ptah said. He's in a great deal of trouble.
As exhausted, bedraggled, and covered with rat scratches as I was, that news set my nerves tingling. Carter needed help. I had to save my brother's ridiculous hide.
Can you send us there? I asked. Ptah smiled. Thought you'd never ask.
He pointed to the nearest wall. The stones dissolved into a portal of swirling sand.
And, my dear, some words of advice.
Ptah's milky eyes studied me.
Courage. Hope. Sacrifice.
I wasn't sure whether he was reading those qualities within me, or giving me a pep talk, or perhaps creating the traits I needed the way he'd created the bar and the platypus. Whatever the case, I suddenly felt warmer inside, filled with new energy.
You're beginning to understand, he told me. Words are the source of all power, and names are more than just a collection of letters. Well, done, Sadie. You may succeed yet.
I stared at the funnel of sand. What will we face on the other side?
Enemies and friends, Ptah said. But which are which, I can't say. If you survive, go to the top of the Great Pyramid. That should do nicely for an entry point into the Duat. When you read the Book of Ra...
He choked, doubling over and dropping his rifle.
I must go, he said, straightening with a great deal of effort. This host can't stand any more. But Walt,
he smiled sadly,
thank you for the beef jerky and juice. There is an answer for you. It's not one you'll like, but it is the best way.
What do you mean? Walt asked. What answer? The farmer blinked. Suddenly his eyes were normal. He looked at us in surprise, then yelled something in Arabic and raised his gun. I grabbed Walt's hand, and together we jumped into the portal.
17. Menshikov hires a happy death squad. I guess we're even, Sadie. First, Walt and I rushed off to save you in London, then you and Walt rushed off to save me. The only one who got shafted on both deals was Walt. Poor guy gets hauled all over the world, pulling us out of trouble. But I'll admit I needed the help. Bess was locked in a glowing fluorescent cage. Zia was convinced we were enemies. My sword and wand were gone. I was holding a crook and flail that were apparently stolen property, and two of the most powerful magicians in the world, Michel Desjardins and Vlad the Inhaler, were ready to arrest me, try me, and execute me. not necessarily in that order. I backed up to the steps of Zia's tomb, but there was no place to go. Red mud stretched in all directions, dotted with wreckage and dead fish. I couldn't run or hide, which gave me two options, surrender or fight. Menshikov's scarred eyes glittered.
Feel free to resist, Kane. Using deadly force would make my job so much easier.
Vladimir, stop. Desjardins said wearily, leaning on his staff.
Carter, don't be foolish. Surrender now.
3 months ago, Desjardins would have been thrilled to blast me to bits. Now he looked sad and tired, like my execution was an unpleasant necessity. Zia stood next to him. She glanced warily at Menshikov as if she could sense something evil about the man. If I could use that, possibly buy some time. "What's your plan, Vlad?" I asked. "You let us get away from St. Petersburg too easily, almost like you want us to awaken Ra." The Russian laughed.
"Is that why I followed you halfway across the world to stop you?"
He did his best to look scornful, but a smile tugged at his lips as if we were sharing a private joke. "You didn't come to stop me," I guessed. "You're counting on us to find the scrolls for you and put them together. Do you need Ra to wake up in order to free Apophis?"
"Enough, Carter."
Desjardins spoke in a monotone, like a surgery patient counting backward, waiting for anesthesia to kick in. I didn't understand why he seemed so apathetic, but Menshikov looked angry enough for both of them. From the hatred in the Russian's eyes, I could tell I'd struck a nerve. "That's it, isn't it?" I said. "Mott and Chaos are connected. To free Apophis, you have to wake Ra, but you want to control the summoning, make sure Ra comes back old and weak." Menshikov's new oaken staff burst into green flames.
"Boy, you have no idea what you're saying."
"Set teased you about a past mistake," I remembered. "You tried to awaken Ra once before, didn't you? Using what? Only the one scroll you had? Is that how you burned your face?"
"Carter," Desjardins interrupted, "Vlad Menshikov is a hero of the House of Life. He tried to destroy that scroll to keep anyone else from using it. That's how he was injured."
For a moment, I was too stunned to speak. "That can't be true."
"You should do your homework, boy."
Menshikov fixed his ruined eyes on me.
"The Menshikovs are descended from the priests of Amun-Ra. You've heard of that temple?"
I tried to recall the stories my dad had told me. I knew Amun-Ra was another name for Ra, the sun god, and his temple. They pretty much controlled Egypt for centuries, I remembered. They opposed Akhenaten when he outlawed the old gods, maybe even assassinated him.
"Indeed,"
Menshikov said.
"My ancestors were champions of the gods. They are the ones who created the Book of Ra and hid its three sections, hoping that someday a worthy magician would reawaken their sun god."
I tried to wrap my mind around that. I could totally see Vlad Menshikov as an ancient bloodthirsty priest. But if you're descended from priests of Ra,
why do I oppose the gods?
Menshikov glanced at the chief lector as if I'd asked a predictably stupid question.
"Because the gods destroyed our civilization. By the time Egypt fell and Lord Iskander bent the path of the gods, even my family had come to realize the truth. The old ways must be forbidden. Yes, I tried to destroy the scroll, to make up for the sins of my ancestors. Those who summon the gods must be wiped out."
I shook my head. "I saw you summon Set. I heard you talk about freeing Apophis. Desjardins, Zia, this guy is lying. He's going to kill you both."
Desjardins looked at me in a kind of daze. Amos had insisted the chief lector was smart, so how could he not understand the threat?
No more, Desjardins said. Come peacefully, Carter Kane, or be destroyed.
I gave Zia one more pleading look. I could see the doubt in her eyes, but she wasn't in any shape to help me. She'd just woken up from a 3-month-long nightmare. She wanted to believe the House of Life was still her home, and Desjardins and Menshikov were the good guys. She didn't want to hear any more about Apophis. I raised the crook and flail. I'm not going peacefully. Menshikov nodded.
Then, destruction it is.
He pointed his staff at me, and my instincts took over. I lashed out with the crook. I was much too far away to reach him, but some invisible force ripped the staff out of Menshikov's hand and sent it flying into the Nile. He held out his wand, but I slashed the air again, and Menshikov went flying. He landed on his back so hard he made a mud angel.
Carter!
Desjardins pushed Zia behind him, his own staff lit with purple fire.
You dare to use the weapons of Ra!
I looked at my hands in amazement. I'd never felt so much power come to me so easily, as if I were meant to be a king. In the back of my mind, I heard Horus's voice, urging me on.
This is your path. This is your birthright.
You're going to kill me anyway, I told Desjardins. My body began to glow. I rose off the ground. For the first time since New Year's, I was encased in the avatar of the Hawk God, a falcon-headed warrior 3 times my normal size. In its hands were massive holographic replicas of the crook and flail. I hadn't paid much attention to the flail, but it was a wicked pain-bringer. A wooden handle with 3 barbed chains, each topped by a spiky metal asterisk, like a combination whip and meat tenderizer. I took a swipe at the ground, and the falcon warrior mirrored my action. The glowing flail pulverized the stone steps of Zia's tomb, sending blocks of limestone flying through the air. Desjardins raised a shield to deflect the shards. Zia's eyes widened. I knew I was probably freaking her out and convincing her I was the bad guy, but I had to protect her. I couldn't let Menshikov take her away.
Combat magic, Desjardins said with disdain. This is what the House of Life was like when we followed the path of the gods, Carter Kane. Magician fighting magician. Backstabbing and duels between the different temples. Do you want those times to return?
It doesn't have to be that way, I said. I don't want to fight you, Desjardins, but Menshikov is a traitor. Get out of here. Let me deal with him. Menshikov rose from the mud, smiling like he enjoyed getting thrown around.
Deal with me. How confident. By all means, Chief Lector, let the boy try. I'll be sure to pick up the pieces when I'm done.
Desjardins started to say,
Vladimir, no, it's not your place.
But Menshikov didn't wait. He stomped the ground with his foot, and the mud turned dry and white all around him. 2 lines of hardening earth snaked toward me, crossing like a DNA helix. I wasn't sure what they would do, but I knew I didn't want them touching me. I smashed at them with my flail, taking out a section of mud large enough for a hot tub. The white lines just kept coming, bleaching their way down the pit and climbing the other side, racing toward me. I tried to move out of their way, but the warrior avatar wasn't exactly speedy. The lines of magic reached my feet. They wove like vines up the avatar's legs until I was tangled to the waist. They squeezed against my shielding, draining my magic, and I heard Menshikov's voice forcing its way into my mind.
Snake,
the voice whispered.
You are a slithering reptile.
I fought back my terror. I'd been turned into an animal against my will once before, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life. This time it was happening in slow motion. The combat avatar fought to maintain its form, but Menshikov's magic was strong. The glowing white vines kept rising, encircling my chest. I swiped at Menshikov with my crook. The invisible force hooked him around the neck and lifted him off the ground.
"Do it," he choked out. "Show me your power, godling."
I raised my flail. One good hit and I could smash Vlad Menshikov like a bug.
"Won't matter,"
he gasped, clawing at his neck.
"Spell will defeat you anyway. Show us you're a murderer, Cain."
I glanced at Zia's terrified face, and I hesitated too long. The white vines encircled my arms. The combat avatar... he gasped, clawing at his neck.
"Spell will defeat you anyway. Show us you're a murderer, Cain."
I glanced at Zia's terrified face, and I hesitated too long. The white vines encircled my arms. The combat avatar crumpled to its knees, and I dropped Menshikov. Pain racked my body. My blood turned cold. The avatar's limbs shrank, the hawk's head slowly changing into the head of a serpent. I could feel my heart slowing, my vision darkening. The taste of venom filled my mouth. Zia cried out, "Stop it! This is too much!"
"On the contrary," Menshikov said, rubbing his chafed neck. "He deserves worse. Chief Lecter, you saw how this boy threatened you. He wants the Pharaoh's throne. He must be destroyed."
Zia tried to run to me, but Desjardins held her back.
"Discontinue the spell, Vladimir," he said. "The boy can be contained in more humane ways."
"Humane, my lord? He's barely human."
The two magicians locked eyes. I don't know what would have happened, but just then a portal opened under Bess's cage. I've seen plenty of portals, but none like this. The whirlpool opened level with the ground, sucking down a trampoline-size area of red sand, dead fish, old lumber, pottery shards, and one glowing fluorescent cage containing a dwarf god. As the cage entered the vortex, the bars broke into splinters of light. Bess unfroze, found himself halfway submerged in sand, and did some creative cursing. Then my sister and Walt shot straight up out of the portal, suspended horizontally, as if they were running toward the sky. When gravity took over, they waved their arms and fell back into the sand. They might have been pulled under, except Bess grabbed them both and managed to haul them out of the whirlpool. Bess dumped them on firm ground. Then he turned to Vlad Menshikov, planted his feet, and ripped off his Hawaiian shirt and shorts like they were made of tissue. His eyes blazed with anger. His speedo was embroidered with the words, "Dwarf Pride," which was something I really didn't need to see. Menshikov only had time to say,
"How?"
"Boo!" yelled Bess. The sound was like the blast of an H-bomb, or a U-bomb, for ugly. The ground shook, the river rippled, my avatar collapsed, and Menshikov's spell dissolved with it, the venom taste in my mouth subsiding, the pressure lifting so I could breathe again. Sadie and Walt were already on the ground. Zia had quickly backed away, but Menshikov and Desjardins got a full blast of ugly right in their faces. Their expressions turned to astonishment, and they disintegrated on the spot. After a moment of shock, Zia gasped, "You killed them!"
"Nah," Bess dusted off his hands. "Just scared them back home. They may be unconscious for a few hours while their brains try to process my magnificent physique, but they'll live. More important," he scowled at Sadie and Walt, "you two had the nerve to anchor a portal on me? Do I look like a relic?"
Sadie and Walt wisely didn't answer that. They got to their feet, brushing off the sand.
"It wasn't our idea," Sadie protested. "Ptah sent us here to help you."
"Ptah?" I said. "Ptah the god?"
"No, Ptah the date farmer. I'll tell you later."
"What's wrong with your hair?" I asked. "It looks like a camel licked it."
"Shut up!"
Then she noticed Zia.
"My god, is that her? The real Zia?"
Zia stumbled back, trying to light up her staff.
"Get away!"
The fire spluttered weakly.
We are not going to hurt you, Sadie promised.
Zia's legs shook. Her hands trembled. Then she did the only logical thing for someone who'd been through her kind of day after a 3-month coma. Her eyes rolled back in her head, and she passed out. Bess grunted.
Strong girl. She held up under a full frontal boo. Still, we'd better pick her up and get out of here. Desjardins won't stay gone forever.
Sadie, I said, did you get the scroll? She pulled all 3 scrolls out of her bag. Part of me was relieved. Part of me was frightened.
We need to get to the Great Pyramid, she said. Please tell me you have a car.
Not only did we have a car, we had a whole bunch of Bedouins. We returned their truck well after dark, but the Bedouins seemed happy to see us, even though we'd brought 3 extra people, one of them unconscious. Somehow, Bess made a deal with them to drive us to Cairo. After a few minutes talking in their tent, he emerged, wearing new robes. The Bedouins came out ripping the remains of his Hawaiian shirt into strips, which they carefully wrapped around their arms, their radio antenna, and their rearview mirror as good luck talismans. We piled into the back of the truck. It was too crowded and noisy to talk much as we drove to Cairo. Bess told us to get some sleep while he kept watch. He promised he'd be nice to Zia if she woke up. Sadie and Walt went straight to sleep, but I stared at the stars for a while. I was painfully aware of Zia, the real Zia, sleeping fitfully right next to me, and the magic weapons of Ra, the crook and the flail, now stashed in my bag. My body was still buzzing from the battle. Menshikov's spell had been broken, but I could still hear his voice in my head, trying to turn me into a cold-blooded reptile. Sort of like him. Finally, I managed to close my eyes. Without magical protection, my ba drifted as soon as I fell asleep. I found myself in the Hall of Ages, in front of the Pharaoh's throne. Between the columns on either side, holographic images shimmered. Just as Sadie had described, the edge of the magic curtain was turning from red to deep purple, indicating a new age. The images in purple were hard to make out, but I thought I saw 2 figures grappling in front of a burning chair.
Yes, said the voice of Horus. The battle approaches.
He appeared in a ripple of light, standing on the steps of the dais where the chief lector usually sat. He was in human form, a muscular young man with bronze skin and a shaved head. Jewels glinted on his leather battle armor, and his hepesh hung at his side. His eyes gleamed, 1 gold, 1 silver. How did you get here? I asked. Isn't this place shielded against gods?
I'm not here, Carter. You are. But we were once joined. I am an echo in your mind, the part of Horus that never left you.
I don't understand.
Just listen. Your situation has changed. You stand on the threshold of greatness.
He pointed at my chest. I looked down and realized I wasn't in my usual ba form. Instead of a bird, I was a human, dressed like Horus in Egyptian armor. In my hands were the crook and flail. These aren't mine, I said. They were buried with Zia.
They could be yours, Horus said. They are the symbols of the Pharaoh, like staff and wand, only 100 times more powerful. Even with no practice, you were able to channel their power. Imagine what we could do together.
He gestured to the empty throne.
You could unite the House of Life as its leader. We could crush our enemies.
I won't deny, part of me felt a thrill. Months ago, the idea of being a leader scared me to death. Now, things had changed. My own understanding of magic had grown. I'd spent 3 months teaching and turning our initiates into a team. I understood the threat we were facing more clearly, and I was beginning to understand how to channel the power of Horus without being overwhelmed. What if Horus was right, and I could lead the gods and magicians against Apophis? I liked the idea of smashing our enemies, getting back at the forces of chaos that had turned our lives upside down.
Then I remembered the way Zia had looked at me when I was about to kill Vlad Menshikov, like I was the monster. I remembered what Desjardins had said about the bad old days when magician fought magician. If Horus was an echo in my mind, maybe I was being affected by his desire to rule. I knew Horus well now. He was a good guy in many ways, brave, honorable, righteous, but he was also ambitious, greedy, jealous, and single-minded when it came to his goals. And his biggest desire was to rule the gods. "The crook and flail belong to Ra," I said. "We have to wake him." Horus tilted his head.
"Even though Apophis wants that to happen? Even though Ra is weak and old? I warned you about the divisions between the gods. You saw how Nekbet and Babi tried to take matters into their own hands. The strife will only get worse. Chaos feeds on weak leaders, divided loyalties. That's what Vladimir Menshikov is after."
The Hall of Ages trembled. Along either wall, the curtain of purple light expanded. As the holographic scene widened, I could tell that the chair was a fiery throne, like the one Sadie had described in her vision of Ra's boat. Two shadowy figures were locked in combat, grappling like wrestlers, but I couldn't tell if they were trying to push each other into the chair or trying to keep each other out of it. "Did Menshikov really try to destroy the Book of Ra?" I asked. Horus's silver eye glinted. It always seemed a little brighter than his golden one, which made me feel disoriented, like the whole world was listing to one side.
"Like most things, Menshikov says, it was a partial truth. He once believed as you do. He thought he could bring back Ra and restore Maat. He imagined himself as the high priest of a glorious new temple, even more powerful than his ancestors. In his pride, he thought he could reconstruct the Book of Ra from the one scroll in his possession. He was wrong. Ra had taken great pains not to be wakened. The curses on the scroll burned Menshikov's eyes. Sunfire seared his throat because he dared to read the words of the spell. After that, Menshikov turned bitter. At first, he plotted to destroy the Book of Ra, but he did not have the power. Then he hit upon a new plan. He would awaken Ra, but for revenge. That's what he's been waiting for all these years. That's why he wants you to collect the scrolls and reconstruct the Book of Ra. Menshikov wants to see the old god swallowed by Apophis. He wants to see the world plunged into darkness and chaos. He is quite insane."
"Oh. Great response, I know, but what do you say to a story like that?"
On the dais next to Horus, the empty throne of the pharaoh seemed to undulate in the purple light. That chair had always intimidated me. Long ago, the pharaoh had been the most powerful ruler in the world. He had controlled an empire that lasted 20 times longer than my own country, the U.S., had existed. How could I be worthy of sitting there?
"You can do it, Carter," Horus urged. "You can take control. Why take the risk of summoning Ra? Your sister will have to read the book, you know. You saw what happened to Menshikov when just one scroll backfired. Can you imagine if three times that much power is unleashed on your sister?" My mouth went dry. Bad enough I'd let Sadie go off to find the last scroll without me. How could I let her take a risk that might scar her like Vlad the Inhaler, or worse?
"You see the truth now," Horus said. "Claim the crook and flail for yourself. Take the throne. Together, we can defeat Apophis. We can return to Brooklyn and protect your friends and your home."
Home. That sounded so tempting.
And our friends were in terrible danger. I've seen firsthand what Vlad Menshikov could do. I imagined little Felix or timid Cleo trying to fight against that kind of magic. I imagined Menshikov turning our young initiates into helpless snakes. I wasn't even sure Amos could stand against him. With the weapons of Ra, I could protect Brooklyn House. Then I looked at the purple images flickering against the wall.
two figures fighting before the fiery throne. That was our future. The key to success wasn't me, or even Horus. It was Ra, the original king of Egyptian gods. Next to the fiery throne of Ra, the pharaoh's seat seemed about as important as a lazy boy recliner. "We're not enough," I told Horus. "We need Ra." The god fixed me with his gold and silver eyes like I was a small bit of prey miles below him, and he was considering whether or not I was worth diving for.
"You do not understand the threat," he decided.
"Stay, Carter, and listen to your enemies plan your death." Horus disappeared. I heard footsteps in the shadows behind the throne, then familiar raspy breathing. I hoped my Ba was invisible. Vladimir Menshikov stepped into the light, half carrying his boss, Desjardins.
"Almost there, my lord," Menshikov said.
The Russian looked well-rested in a new white suit. The only sign of our recent fight was the bandage on his neck from where I'd crooked him. Desjardins, however, looked like he'd aged a decade in a few hours. He stumbled along, leaning on Menshikov. His face was gaunt. His hair had turned stark white, and I didn't think it was all because he had seen Bess in a Speedo. Menshikov tried to ease him onto the pharaoh's throne, but Desjardins protested.
"Never, Vladimir. The step.
"But surely, Lord, in your condition..."
"Never."
Desjardins settled on the steps at the foot of the throne. I couldn't believe how much worse he looked.
"Mott is failing."
Desjardins held out his hand. A weak cloud of hieroglyphs drifted from his fingertips into the air.
"The power of Mott once sustained me, Vladimir. Now it seems to be sapping my life force. It is all I can do."
His voice trailed off.
"Fear not, my lord," Menshikov said. "Once the Kains are dealt with, all will be well."
"Will it?"
Desjardins looked up, and for a moment his eyes flared with anger like they used to.
"Don't you ever have doubts, Vladimir?"
"No, my lord," said the Russian. "I have given my life to fighting the gods. I will continue to do so. If I may be so bold, Chief Lector, you should not have allowed Amos Cain into your presence. His words are like poison."
Desjardins caught a hieroglyph from the air and studied it as it revolved in his palm. I didn't recognize the symbol, but it reminded me of a traffic light with a stick figure guy standing next to it.
"Menhead," Desjardins said. "The scribe's palette."
I looked at the dimly flickering symbol, and I could see the resemblance to the writing tools in my supply bag. The rectangle was the palette with places for black and red ink. The stick figure on one side was a writing stylus attached with a string.
"Yes, my lord,"
Menshikov said.
"How interesting."
"It was my grandfather's favorite symbol," Desjardins mused. "Jean-François Champollion, you know. He broke the code of hieroglyphics using the Rosetta Stone, the first man outside the House of Life to do so."
"Indeed, my lord. I have heard the story."
A thousand times, his expression seemed to say.
"He rose from nothing to become a great scientist," Desjardins continued, "and a great magician, respected by mortals and magicians alike."
Menshikov smiled like he was humoring a child who was becoming annoying.
"And now you are Chief Lector. He would be proud."
"Would he?" Desjardins wondered. "When Iskander accepted my family into the House of Life, he said he welcomed the new blood and new ideas. He hoped we would reinvigorate the house. Yet what did we contribute? We changed nothing. We questioned nothing. The house has grown weak. We have fewer initiates every year.
Ah, my lord.
Menshikov bared his teeth.
Let me show you. We are not weak. Your attack force is assembled.
He clapped his hands. At the far end of the hall, the huge bronze doors opened. At first, I couldn't believe my eyes, but as the small army marched toward us, I got more and more alarmed. The dozen magicians were the least scary part of the group. They were mostly older men and women in traditional linen robes. Many had coal around their eyes and hieroglyphic tattoos on their hands and faces. Some wore more amulets than Walt. The men had shaved heads. The women wore their hair short or tied back in ponytails. All of them had grim expressions, like an angry mob of peasants out to burn the Frankenstein monster, except instead of pitchforks, they were armed with staffs and wands. Several had swords, too. Marching on either side of them were demons, about 20 in all. I'd fought demons before, but something about these was different. They moved with more confidence, like they shared a sense of purpose. They radiated evil so strongly, my Ba felt like it was getting a suntan. Their skin was every color, from green to black to violet. Some were dressed in armor, some in animal hides, some in flannel pajamas. One had a chainsaw for a head. Another had a guillotine. A third had a foot sprouting between his shoulders. Even scarier than the demons were the winged snakes. Yeah, I know, you're thinking, not more snakes. Believe me, after getting bit by the Chesuhiru in St. Petersburg, I wasn't happy to see them either. These weren't three-headed, and they weren't any bigger than normal snakes, but just looking at them gave me the creeps. Imagine a cobra with the wings of an eagle. Now imagine it zipping through the air, exhaling long jets of fire like a flamethrower. Half a dozen of these monsters circled the attack squad, darting in and out and spitting fire. It was a miracle none of the magicians got torched. As the group approached, Desjardins struggled to his feet. The magicians and demons knelt before him. One of the winged snakes flew in front of the chief lector, and Desjardins snatched it out of the air with surprising speed. The snake wriggled in his fist, but didn't try to strike.
A Urias, Desjardins asked. This is dangerous, Vladimir. These are creatures of Ra.
Menshikov inclined his head.
They once served the temple of Amun-Ra, Chief Lector, but do not worry. Because of my ancestry, I can control them. I thought it fitting, using creatures of the Sun God to destroy those who would wake him.
Desjardins released the snake, which spouted fire and flew away.
And the demons? Desjardins asked.
Since when do we use creatures of chaos?
They are well controlled, my lord.
Menshikov's voice sounded strained, as if he were growing tired of humoring his boss.
These mages know the proper binding spells. I handpicked them from gnomes around the world. They have great skill.
The chief lector focused on an Asian man in blue robes.
Kwai, isn't it?
The man nodded.
As I recall, Desjardins said, you were exiled to the 300th gnome in North Korea for murdering a fellow magician. And you, Sarah Jacoby.
He pointed to a woman with white robes and spiky black hair.
You were sent to Antarctica for causing the tsunami in the Indian Ocean.
Menshikov cleared his throat.
My lord, many of these magicians have had issues in the past, but...
They are ruthless murderers and thieves, Desjardins said. The worst of our house.
But they are anxious to prove their loyalty,
Menshikov assured him.
They are happy to do it.
He grinned at his minions, as if encouraging them to look happy. None of them did.
Besides, my lord,
Menshikov continued quickly,
If you want Brooklyn House destroyed, we must be ruthless. It is for the good of Mott.
Desjardins frowned.
And you, Vladimir, will you lead them?
No, my lord. I have full confidence that this, fine group can deal with Brooklyn on their own. They will attack at sunset. As for me, I will follow the Cairns into the Duat and deal with them personally. You, my lord, should stay here and rest. I will send a scryer to your quarters so you may observe our progress.
Stay here, Desjardins quoted bitterly, and observe. Menshikov bowed.
We will save the House of Life, I swear it. The Cairns will be destroyed, the gods put back into exile. Mott will be restored.
I hoped Desjardins would come to his senses and call off the attack. Instead, his shoulders slumped. He turned his back on Menshikov and stared at the empty throne of the pharaoh.
Go, he said wearily. Get those creatures out of my sight.
Menshikov smiled.
My lord.
He turned and marched down the Hall of Ages with his personal army in tow. Once they were gone, Desjardins held up his hand. An orb of light fluttered from the ceiling and rested on his palm.
Bring me the Book of Overcoming Apophis, Desjardins told the light. I must consult it.
The magic orb dipped as if bowing, then raced off. Desjardins turned toward the purple curtain of light, the image of two figures fighting over a throne of fire.
I will observe, Vladimir, he murmured to himself, but I will not stay and rest.
The scene faded, and my Ba returned to my body. 18. Gambling on Doomsday Eve. For the second time that week, I woke on a sofa in a hotel room with no idea how I'd gotten there. The room wasn't nearly as nice as the Four Seasons Alexandria. The walls were cracked plaster. Exposed beams sagged along the ceiling. A portable fan hummed on the coffee table, but the air was as hot as a blast furnace. Afternoon light streamed through the open windows. From below came the sounds of cars honking and merchants hawking their wares in Arabic. The breeze smelled of exhaust, animal manure, and apple shisha, the fruity molasses scent of water pipe smoke. In other words, I knew we must be in Cairo. At the window, Sadie, Bess, Walt, and Zia were sitting around a table playing a board game like old friends. The scene was so bizarre, I thought I must still be dreaming. Then Sadie noticed I was awake.
Well, well, next time you take an extended bar trip, Carter, do let us know in advance. It's not fun carrying you up three flights of stairs.
I rubbed my throbbing head. How long was I out?
Longer than me, Zia said.
She looked amazing, calm and rested. Her freshly washed hair was swept behind her ears, and she wore a new white sleeveless dress that made her bronze skin glow. I guess I was staring at her pretty hard because she dropped her gaze. Her throat turned red.
It's 3 in the afternoon, she said. I've been up since 10 this morning.
You look better?
She raised her eyebrows like she was challenging me to deny it.
You missed the excitement.
I tried to fight. I tried to escape. This is our 3rd hotel room.
The first one caught fire, Bess said.
The 2nd one exploded, Walt said.
I said I was sorry.
Zia frowned.
At any rate, your sister finally calmed me down. Which took several hours, Sadie said, and all my diplomatic skill.
You have diplomatic skill? I asked. Sadie rolled her eyes.
As if you'd notice, Carter. Your sister is quite intelligent, Zia said. She convinced me to reserve judgment on your plans until you woke up and we could talk. She's quite persuasive.
Thank you, Sadie said smugly.
I stared at them both, and a feeling of terror set in. You're getting along? You can't get along. You and Sadie can't stand each other.
That was a shabti kata, Zia said, though her neck was still bright red.
I find Sadie admirable. You see, Sadie said, I'm admirable.
This is a nightmare. I sat up and the blankets fell away. I looked down and found I was wearing Pokemon pajamas.
Sadie, I said, I'm going to kill you.
She batted her eyes innocently.
But the street merchant gave us a very good deal on those. Walt said they would fit you.
Walt raised his hands. Don't blame me, man. I tried to stick up for you. Bess snorted, then did a pretty good imitation of Walt's voice.
At least get the extra large ones with Pikachu.
Carter, your stuff's in the bathroom. Now, are we playing Senate or not?
I stumbled into the bathroom and was relieved to find a set of normal clothes waiting for me. Fresh underwear, jeans, and a t-shirt that did not feature Pikachu. The shower made a sound like a dying elephant when I tried to turn it on, but I managed to run some rusty-smelling water in the sink and wash up as best I could. When I came out again, I didn't exactly feel good as new, but at least I didn't smell like dead fish and goat meat. My four companions were still playing Senet. I'd heard of the game, supposedly one of the oldest in the world, but I'd never seen it played. The board was a rectangle with blue and white checkered squares, three rows of 10 spaces each. The game pieces were white and blue circles. Instead of dice, you threw four strips of ivory like popsicle sticks, blank on one side and marked with hieroglyphs on the other.
I thought the rules of this game were lost, I said.
Bess raised an eyebrow.
Maybe to you mortals. The gods never forgot.
It's quite easy, Sadie said. You make an S around the board. First team to get all their pieces to the end wins.
Ha! Bess said. There's much more to it than that. It takes years to master.
Is that so, Dwarf God?
Zia tossed the four sticks, and all of them came up marked.
Master that.
Sadie and Zia gave each other a high five. Apparently, they were a team. Sadie moved a blue piece and bumped a white piece back to start.
Walt, Bess grumbled. I told you not to move that piece.
It isn't my fault.
Sadie smiled at me.
It's girls versus boys. We're playing for Vlad Menshikov's sunglasses.
She held up the broken white shades that Set had given her in St. Petersburg. The world is about to end, I said. And you're gambling over sunglasses?
Hey, man. Walt said. We're totally multitasking. We've been talking for like 6 hours, but we had to wait for you to wake up to make any decisions, right?
Besides, Sadie said, Bess assures us that you cannot play Senet without gambling. It would shake the foundations of Mott.
That's true, said the dwarf. Walt, roll already.
Walt threw the sticks and three came up blank. Bess cursed.
We need a two to move out of the House of Rhea Tomb, kid. Did I not explain that?
Sorry. I wasn't sure what else to do, so I pulled up a chair. The view out the window was better than I'd realized. About a mile away, the pyramids of Giza gleamed red in the afternoon light. We must have been in the southwest outskirts of the city, near El Mansouria. I'd been through this neighborhood a dozen times with my dad on our way to various dig sites, but it was still disorienting to see the pyramids so close. I had a million questions. I needed to tell my friends about my Ba vision. But before I could get up the nerve, Sadie launched into a long explanation of what they'd been up to while I was unconscious. Mostly, she concentrated on how funny I looked when I slept, and the various whimpering noises I'd made as they pulled me out of the first two burning hotel rooms. She described the excellent fresh-baked flatbread, falafel, and spiced beef they'd had for lunch.
Oh, sorry, we didn't save you any.
And the great deals they'd gotten shopping in the souk, the local open-air market.
You went shopping? I said.
Well, of course, she said. We can't do anything until sunset anyway. Bess said so.
What do you mean?
Bess tossed the sticks and moved one of his pieces to the home space.
The equinox, kid. We're close enough now. All the portals in the world will shut down except for two times. Sunset and sunrise, when night and day are perfectly balanced.
At any rate, Sadie said, if we want to find Ra, we'll have to follow his journey, which means going into the Duat at sunset and coming back out at sunrise.
How do you know that? I asked.
She pulled a scroll from her bag, a cylinder of papyrus much thicker than the ones we'd collected. The edges glowed like fire.
The Book of Ra, she said. I put it together. You may thank me now.
My head started to spin. I remembered what Horace had said in my vision about the scroll burning Menshikov's face.
You mean you read it without any trouble?
She shrugged.
Just the introduction. Warnings, instructions, that sort of thing. I won't read the actual spell until we find Ra, but I know where we're going.
If we decide to go, I said. That got everyone's attention.
If?
Zia asked. She was so close it was painful, but I could feel the distance she was putting between us, leaning away from me, tensing her shoulders, warning me to respect her space.
Sadie told me you were quite determined.
I was, I said, until I learned what Menshikov is planning. I told them what I'd seen in my vision, about Menshikov's strike force heading to Brooklyn at sunset, and his plans to track us personally through the Duat. I explained what Horace said about the dangers of waking Ra, and how I could use the crook and flail instead to fight Apophis.
But those symbols are sacred to Ra, Zia said.
They belong to any pharaoh who is strong enough to wield them, I said. If we don't help Amos in Brooklyn,
your uncle and all your friends will be destroyed, Bess said. From what you've described, Menshikov has put together a nasty little army. Uri, the flaming snakes, they're very bad news. Even if Bast gets back in time to help.
We need to let Amos know, Walt said. At least warn him. You have a scrying bowl? I asked.
Better. He pulled out a cell phone.
What do I tell him? Are we going back?
I wavered. How could I leave Amos and my friends alone against an evil army?
Part of me was itching to take up the Pharaoh's weapons and smash our enemies. Horace's voice was still inside me, urging me to take charge.
Carter, you can't go to Brooklyn.
Zia met my eyes, and I realized the fear and panic hadn't left her. She was holding those feelings back, but they were still bubbling under the surface.
What I saw at Red Sands, that disturbed me too much.
I felt like she'd just stomped on my heart.
Look, I'm sorry about the Avatar thing, the crook and flail. I didn't mean to freak you out, but...
Carter, you didn't disturb me. Vlad Menshikov did.
Oh. Right.
She took a shaky breath.
I never trusted that man. When I graduated from initiate training, Menshikov requested I be assigned to his gnome. Thankfully, Iskander declined.
So, why can't I go to Brooklyn? Zia examined the Senate board as if it were a war map.
I believe you're telling the truth. Menshikov is a traitor. What you described in your vision, I think Desjardins is being affected by evil magic. It's not Mart's failing that's draining his life force.
It's Menshikov, Sadie guessed.
I believe so.
Zia's voice became hoarse.
And I believe my old mentor, Iskander, was trying to protect me when he put me into that tomb. It was not a mistake that he let me hear the voice of Apophis in my dreams. It was some sort of warning. One last lesson. He hid the crook and flail with me for a reason. Perhaps he knew you would find me. At any rate, Menshikov must be stopped.
But you just said I couldn't go to Brooklyn, I protested.
I meant that you can't abandon your quest.
I think Iskander foresaw this path. He believed the gods must unite with the House of Life, and I trust his judgment. You have to awaken Ra.
Hearing Zia say it, I felt for the first time like our quest was real, and crucial, and very, very crazy. But I also felt a little spark of hope. Maybe she didn't hate me completely. Sadie picked up the Senate sticks.
Well, that's sorted, then. At sunset, we'll open a portal at the top of the Great Pyramid. We'll follow the Sunboat's old course down the River of Night, find Ra, wake him, and bring him out again at dawn. And possibly find some place for dinner along the way, because I'm hungry again.
It'll be dangerous,
Bess said.
Reckless. Probably fatal.
So, an average day for us, I summed up. Walt frowned, still holding his phone. Then what should I tell Amos? He's on his own?
Not quite, Zia said. I'll go to